Asia enthusiasts. And I want to pause, actually, to mention that I should have chosen a different intro phrase for the podcast. Have you ever tried saying anesthesia enthusiasts out loud? Try it. I normally have to record several different versions for every podcast. In any case, welcome to another episode of Style Points. We don't have an RSI this month. My co-host, Nate Moore, has been very busy representing the University of Cincinnati at the ASA, as well as doing application review for this year's interview season. However, I am pleased to introduce one of my friends and colleagues, Dr. Kristen Horton. She completed her residency and cardiac fellowship here at UC and is the chair of the Clinical Competency Committee. She's one of the best crisis managers that I know. Without further ado, here's Kristen. Okay, you ready?
I'm terrible at stuff like this.
You don't know that yet. How have you done stuff like this before?
No. I feel like anytime I'm asked to ad-lib questions, I just get jumbled sometimes, but that's okay.
So you wrote the sheet.
That is why I wrote the cardiac case. That was like literally everything that could go wrong did go wrong. But I don't want other cardiac people listening being like, that makes no sense. Why would you do it that way? It's like, oh, JK, I just didn't remember it right.
I don't think any of the cardiac people here will question you. I just don't. Kristen, thanks for joining us. Everyone seems to describe you as a black cloud. Can you tell me a little bit about what that means to you?
I feel like it is kind of just this thing where, like, if bad things are going to happen in a situation, I'm probably going to be involved. I feel like I get put into cases that everybody's like, this should go straight forward. And then it doesn't, for reasons that are mostly beyond my control. And that's kind of been an ongoing thing since residency.
You always seem to be in seemingly insane cases where very rare things that, by the way, are not your fault seem to happen. And then you are somehow able to manage it and get the patient through safely. That's sort of been your calling card for a long time. Would you say that that's the case?
Yeah.
So, well, the thing that you call them and what I was excited to call the title of this episode is dumpster fires. Tell me more about that.
I think I initially heard the term on one of our IC rotations when I was a resident. It was one of the CCAT fellows who had mentioned it. And then, of course, it's kind of caught fire, I guess, and mainstream memes and whatnot.
Yeah, after COVID, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And so it kind of fit. Like, you know, normally we were talking like disaster cases or, you know, just a terrible, terrible case, you know, when I was a resident. And then the dumpster fire thing just really seemed to encompass of just like, all of this is going terrible. Like, it's fine. This is fine. Everything's fine. It's burning down around me, but we're okay. Kind of encompassed it. And so we rolled with it.
So what do you think it is? How do these cases find you? Is it just bad luck or what?
I used to think that. Part of it, I think, is the fact that I don't know if you'd say dabble, but like I do a bunch of different stuff, right? So I did cardiac fellowship. So I'm taking care of the cardiac cases where just by nature, they're higher risk cases. I'm involved in the liver transplant team. Again, higher, sicker people. I do OB. I do the OB combined cardiac clinic, which by nature puts you at the situation where you're going to be taking care of these high-risk cardiac patients having babies. So part of it, I think, is my own doing of just keeping the skill sets to get me involved in a lot of potential shenanigans. And then I just feel like some of it is just, I don't know if you call it bad luck. I guess for the patients, maybe it's good luck that I'm there. but definitely just a knack for attracting shenanigans.
That's fantastic. So tell me about some of the memorable dumpster fire cases that you've had. What's given you that label?
There are too many to think about coming residency, but we'll start from as an attending. 4 days in, I did my first TAVR as an attending.
Mm-hmm. A TAVR is?
It's like a transvenous aortic valve replacement. Mm-hmm. At this time, we were still doing them under general anesthesia. And for this case, he had severe aortic stenosis, getting worked up for a kidney transplant. Mm-hmm. And so he comes in, he's complaining of chest pain, which he previously had a drug-eluting stent placed. He'd had instant restenosis before. The stent was like 3 months prior. We got an EKG, no ST changes. We're going to be in the hybrid operating room anyway with fluoro and cath lab capabilities. So we discuss a bunch of things. decide we're going to go ahead with the case. We'll do a left heart cath beforehand. Cath him, coronaries are clean, stents clean. Yay, let's proceed with the TAVR. There are some complications deploying the valve. We had to rapid pace him like 3 or 4 times, up to 180 beats per minute. After the last time when we got the valve deployed, he stayed in VT after we turned the pacer off, never came back. EF was like 10. We crashed onto bypass, which just happened to be primed because the perfusionist said they were teaching their student. They don't normally prime it, and it's the first time we had to crash on bypass in 2 years. So I call in my backup peeps who come racing to help and finally get the guy back. We wound up leaving on ECMO. And so that was just like a, okay, great. This has continued from residency. I've had malignant hyperthermia after a wisdom tooth extraction in an otherwise relatively healthy young person.
I remember seeing that poster.
Yep. What else did we do? We did a liver transplant that got anaphylaxis before the case started. Plenty of nightmare cardiac cases. A severe pulmonary hypertension patient getting a C-section that crashed onto ECMO. Anticipated, we'd planned, but still. So it's a wide variety.
You've done so many of these dumpster fire cases that you actually have stickers. Is that correct?
Correct.
Tell me about the stickers.
So this actually started on a very slow OB day, which is not common for me. When me and the current OB fellow, or previous, I guess, OB fellow current at the time, were talking about just the shenanigans that I tend to get into. And we were actually talking about TAVRs. And so she had actually brought up the idea of that she had seen some dumpster fire stickers on Etsy and that we should hand those out for TAVR cases that we were in. But those don't always go that crazily. And so we got a sheet of these stickers and I started handing them out to the residents. And some attendings who have survived these dumpster fire cases with me at the end. So we debrief, we talk about all the things, and then they get to pick their color of dumpster fire sticker because I think there's like 9 of them.
Excellent.
And the first 2 residents like really thought it was kind of fun, you know. It's some like kind of a badge of honor of like, I don't want to have to be here, but if I am, like, this is kind of cool. And so they started wearing them on their badges. And I had 2 residents that every time we were paired together, shenanigans ensued. So we were the dark cloud duos, essentially. And so as they were collecting these dumpster fire stickers, they had gotten 4 or 5 at the time. And so I was like, okay, if you get 5 dumpster fire stickers, you're going to graduate to a dumpster phoenix. And so I presented them with a uniquely made dumpster phoenix lapel pin at graduation. Which they thought was hilarious, and we've continued to do so. And I now have 3 dumpster phoenixes that I have mentored.
That is fantastic. Do you have their names? Do you know who the dumpster phoenixes are? Can you tell us?
Cameron Harmon, who was one of our prior residents. Sean Nguyen, who's currently one of our faculty now. And then Jamie McGrath, who's doing a cardiac fellowship.
Yeah, that certainly tracks. I can certainly imagine all 3 of them being dumpster phoenixes. You basically graduated during my first year of being an attending. And then you did your cardiac fellowship during my second year of being an attending. And right after that, you won the Golden Apple Teaching Award your first year out. And you've been involved in the residency ever since. And also you took over the Clinical Competency Committee for me. With all the time that you've spent teaching and helping residents through these disaster situations, how do you stay calm in those moments?
I think a lot of that goes way, way back to when I was a kid and how we got interested in medicine, which is a little bit of a different story. But my grandmother used to basically say, like, look, you have to stay calm in these situations. Like, calm may save you. Panic's going to kill everybody. And
what kind of situations were you in when you were a kid that calm was going to save everybody?
So my Nana lived on a dirt road in the middle of nowhere. The closest hospital was about a 45-minute ambulance call away. And in the summer, people would come careening off this dirt road into her yard. We were living with her at the time. I was about 7. And so we would go out and pull people out of these cars, out of the ditch, and basically triage them until the ambulance would get there. So we're holding pressure on lacerations. People are bleeding everywhere. People are screaming. I'm 7. We're trying to help, right? And it didn't happen like a ton of time, but it happened enough. That was where my like initial interest in medicine started too. But it was like, you got to stay calm.
Was it like a weekly thing that there was a big disaster outside your house?
At least once or twice a month in the summer. I feel like that's a pretty good gauge.
This seems like a failure of civic engineering.
It was. And they eventually like just totally bypassed that. So now it's a dead end road and they like paved over and did a highway nearby.
That's probably better.
Yes, but it took a while. And so I think just from then, it was almost like a switch would flip. And so I just try to like take out any emotional investment and just think. And I feel like that helps. And then going through med school and like rotations and seeing the other anesthesiologists when I was doing those rotations, you know, things hit the fan and everybody's panicking. I feel like everybody in the OR looks to the anesthesiologist. To be the calm one. And my mentors and the people I really respected were always just like super calm. And so I think trying to prepare for things and being pretty confident in my training helps me at least outwardly model calm, because if you are also outwardly panicking, everybody else may be too.
That makes a lot of sense. And I've talked to a lot of other anesthesiologists on Style Points about maintaining that outward sense of calm, even though maybe inside it might not be maybe the same. Do you find that over time you have more of a sense of calm than you used to, or
100%. Does it ever go? I think for the vast majority of situations, legit actually calmer internally than when I first started. And some of that's just experiencing things and seeing things before and kind of knowing what to do and having a wider differential and things like that.
So how do you teach other residents how to prepare for these type of situations?
I think the first thing is to think about the possibility of getting into these situations. I know, like, as a resident, soon after I was dubbed the black cloud and bad things just kept happening, every case I would go into, I'm like, okay, what is the nightmare scenario that could happen out of this case? Like, I know it's a lap appy, but like air embolus, right? Like that could happen. And so that would be part of the stuff I would focus my reading on for that day of like, I can't prevent the disasters, but how can I prepare for them? And so talking to the residents about, even if it's, you know, a basic lap appy, try to think about what could go wrong. I mean, there's always the anesthesia things, right? Difficult airway, malignant hyperthermia, crazy things that we don't expect to see. But what are the things that just from a surgical standpoint could also go wrong, and preparing for that and having read about it or thought about it before, I think just in itself lends to a little more feeling of, I know what's going on, and a little less tendency to panic and be like, oh my God, what's happening?
When you're in some of these critical dumpster fire scenarios, one of the things that residents say that you'll do is you are still teaching even in those moments. How do you get into that mindset of teaching and still modeling calmness for the team?
I just talk out loud. Everything that's going through my head, clinically, not the emotional side, but everything that clinically is going through my head. So like, here's what's happening now. You know, I think, you know, here's my differential of 8 things that could be going on. Here's what we need to be thinking about. Here's what we need to be doing. Or just here's what I'm doing. We'll talk about it in a minute as to why, if, you know, time is really of the essence. But a lot of it is just going through my thought process out loud, and they just tend to be bystanders who are benefiting from that.
Yeah, that's fair. Sometimes residents will be trying to do things to help, but they might be struggling a little bit, whether it's putting in a line or with an airway. How do you determine where the line is for when you need to step in and do something versus letting them maybe struggle a little bit, making sure that they are getting a good learning opportunity from it?
I think that's a really hard thing to balance sometimes. And that's one of the trickier things, I think, for switching from like being a resident and becoming an attending, is knowing where that line is. And I was much quicker to jump in earlier than I am now. And now I think the biggest thing is patient safety, or at least patient tolerance, because like we do neuraxial up on OB. Obviously, if the patient's not tolerating it well, this is no longer a good learning opportunity. Like, we need to get this in and get this done. So patient safety does come first. And I will not let it get to a point where I don't think I can rescue the situation. So if I know they have low reserve and they're going to desaturate, you know, pretty quickly, like, you get one shot. If they're an easy airway, easy mask, I have no concerns, sure, take two or three as long as we're not damaging the airway. Same thing with lines. If you have good technique and it's just a struggle with getting a wire in or something like that, I'll let you keep going. If you can't keep your needle in view or we've caused a hematoma or only have one or two shots, maybe I step in earlier.
That makes a lot of sense. You are the chair of the clinical competency committee here. That means that you are ultimately responsible for checking residents off, making sure that they are competent clinically across a wide variety of domains. But, you know, sometimes residents can struggle. You are known, though, for having good conversations with residents when they are struggling, and you've been a mentor to a lot of people. How do you approach some of these conversations with residents that might be struggling with something or who are beating themselves up about a situation that didn't go well?
Definitely on the beating yourself up, I can relate. There's a lot of imposter syndrome that I feel like does not get talked about very much in this specialty. And I think when things don't go well, especially with residency and training, your first thought is, you know, what did I do wrong or what could I have done better? As far as, you know, stuff that comes up in clinical competence committee, a lot of times I'll go back and try to talk to whoever put in evaluations or whoever talked to me that would suggest somebody is struggling to get their background first. And then I really like to do these as sit down things. So I'll try to pull the resident aside when we have time and we're not, you know, dealing with clinical constraints or, you know, in the OR taking care of a patient and trying to have an emotionally charged conversation. Starbucks is often involved. And just sit through and talk like, hey, you know, either I heard this or like, you know, I was made aware that maybe you're having a little bit of a rough time. Like, can we talk about this? How do you feel things have been going? And then kind of trying to interweave it from there to try to get their view on it before just jumping in and being like, well, I've heard X, Y, Z.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of times I find that context is really key with a lot of the things that we discuss with the residents, making sure that we're on the same page as them, making sure that we understand the whole situation, because often there can be a little bit more than meets the eye about any one evaluation or situation.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I remember that we've talked about in the past, just in passing, is sort of your pathway towards medicine. And I've always thought it was very interesting. I wonder if you'd be willing to share maybe the time after you saved all the traumas that showed up at your front door and before you made it all the way to anesthesia residency.
Sure. So pulling people out of my Nana's yard was kind of the beginning. She was always very interested in medicine, but did not have the opportunity to even finish, I think, even middle school. And nobody in my family had ever gone to college. So, of course, med school was a pipe dream. But she would watch all these medical documentaries, and I always thought it was, like, super cool. Got through high school. I went to a very small high school. Your career path was essentially you could work at the prison, the boot camp, or the barge on the river. They really didn't talk to you about college. I happened to get an opportunity to participate in a scholarship competition from a neighboring county college for, like, underprivileged kids, essentially. And so I did that, and it was like an interview and an essay competition that you had to write there, and actually won, which was incredible because I'd previously gone through MEPS and was going to join the Air Force to get to college. And so I got the call that I won in March. I guess it was 2006, maybe.
Do you remember what your essay was about?
It was something about Martin Luther King. Like, Martin Luther King said something about, you know, it's a man's true character is not revealed in times of peace, but like in times of strife. That's definitely paraphrasing. But like,
we'll accept that.
Pick three, give three examples of people that you think meet this criteria or, you know, fit the situation. And so I chose Abe Lincoln, Martin Luther King himself, and then one of my personal friends as like a historical, here's why he said this, and here's like how we relate this to like the common person. And so they thought that was good. So I got that. They said it was going to be a full ride scholarship. That was super exciting. Couldn't believe it. Thought they were kidding. Called my mom in tears, I'm pretty sure. And was very excited. Talked to my recruiter. He was like, cool. You haven't gone to boot camp yet. Like, you're out. went to college, signed a contract saying I would do 4 years or owe them money back. Reasonable. Then found out they'd never put anybody into med school. They were had a very successful nursing program, which great, not what I wanted to do. So I figured out what classes I need to take the MCAT. Took a little finagling, had some professors that really jumped in and helped. Had to take physics one and physics two at the same time. Calculus advanced level by myself because they didn't actually teach that because we didn't have enough people to be in the class. Fun times. Took the MCAT, didn't do so hot, didn't even apply that year. Took a summer off, taught myself the rest of the organic chemistry book and worked construction and built cars during that time to pay for things. managed to get an interview at University of Tennessee Health Science Center. I did not know you're supposed to apply to like 30 med schools. I think I applied to three. Got that interview, went, had to do a program during their summer that was incredible. That was basically like, we're glad you graduated top of your class of college, but for all we know, you colored inside the lines because they don't have a track record. So basically, if you can hack it for this pretend med school course in the summer, then we'll let you in. And so I did that, and that went well. Got to med school. Yay.
Wow. That is pretty incredible. And as one of the associate program directors, I read personal statements all the time. And I wouldn't have been in the program director's office at that time when you were applying, but I would have loved to see a personal statement like that. I bet that was a really good one.
I like to think so. I got asked to talk about the road, and one of the people interviewing asked me to comment on the cabinets they were building for their kids' room. I was like, you know what? That's fair. Like, it's not every day you see I work construction for three summers.
And maybe you could fix my car too while you're on it.
Potentially. I'm really good at YouTube.
That is something that I tell a lot of my patients before they go off to sleep is that I looked up how to do anesthesia on YouTube right before, so they should feel comfortable and confident with their anesthesia care. How do you think your background has really influenced the way that you connect with both trainees and with your patients?
I think it makes me more relatable. I try to hold on to that. I think a lot of stuff gets lost in communication. I remember like my Nana had to have a bunch of surgical procedures and, you know, stuff like that. And hearing them talk about, well, I don't know what the doctor said. They said a bunch of big words, or, you know, being there and hearing a bunch of big words that nobody knows what they mean. And then even seeing it on this side when you're, you know, anesthesia is a very team sport, but we often operate in isolation. And so I remember being on call with one of my co-residents talking to someone who had a history of IV drug use and was in the burn unit and having a lot of pain. And this co-resident launched into a discussion about opioid receptors and down regulation and why this wasn't going to work. And I'm just sitting there thinking, prior to med school, I would have had no idea what that means. My mom, if you're talking to her, has no idea what that means. And it was kind of funny because after they got done talking, she's like, can you tell me what he just said? Because none of that makes sense. I'm like, nothing we gave you is going to be as good as what you were using. Right. And so I think finding a way to break it down to very simple terms for anything, whether it's clinical stuff or just, you know, the hard discussions. Here's what I'm seeing is really relatable. And I really try to hold on to the experiences that I had as a resident and put myself in their shoes because I feel like people tend to forget what that's like. And I hear often, like, I'm so happy that you remember what that's like or that you can put yourself back there. And then if I'm explaining anything, I pretend I'm explaining it to my mom. Very simple. And I try to put things in simple terms of, you know, electrical things, plumbing, pipes, tubes, buckets. I feel like that helps.
That's how you won your Golden Apple Teaching Award.
Yes.
Chaos is something that you're really good at managing at work, but you also have two little kids at home.
Yeah.
How do you manage your home life? Is it as much of a dumpster fire there trying to put your kids to bed versus maybe an aortic dissection?
At times, at least at the aortic dissection, for the most part, the pathophysiology follows general rules. I have all of the tools at my disposal and I know what to expect. Whereas bedtime with my 3.5-year-old, not always the case. He will straight up call you out. Not if you even skip a page while reading one of his 5 books that he not only demands but counts down. We'll call you out if you've skipped a word. Yeah. And, you know, God forbid you don't have the toast or the bagel that he requests at 8:52 because it's bedtime, you know. And he will say, you need to go to the store. Lovely input, child. But no, I manage the chaos at home. One, with the help of my husband, who does work from home. The kids are in daycare, but he is phenomenal at doing the running and taking care of them and stepping in when I can't because I'm here. And bedtime's hit or miss.
You know, my kids don't have as set a routine with bedtime. There's not like a series of 5 books to read, but they will a lot of times pick out a new or different book that they want to read. And with my 4 almost 5-year-old now, she will sometimes pick books that are too long. Mm-hmm. And we have no chance of getting through that book before bedtime. So I will admit that I have skipped a page or two.
Yeah,
on occasion.
We have removed some of the very, very long books. Or we tell him that he's only getting one that night. My husband loves to read St. George and the Dragon to him. That is a long book. Buddy, you get 1 book tonight. Or you can have 5 books and we read more.
Yeah, you have to think of system level solutions for these sorts of things. Just take it out of the options menu. How has being a parent changed how you approach crisis management at work, or has it?
I don't think it's approached crisis management. I don't think it's changed how I approach crisis management. I do think it's changed how I communicate with people. I think communication is very important anyway, but having to explain to a 3.5-year-old how you do things really helps break it down.
Yeah.
Right. And it may be something as simple as like, he loves to start the bottle washer. He knows you put in the tablet, you push this button, you hold for 3 seconds, you push the next button, you start the next button. He's got it. So definitely talking to, especially like the CA1s as they're starting procedures and things like that, I think about how would I explain this to my 3.5-year-old? Not, I don't have to dumb it down, but like really clarifying the steps. And maybe in a crisis situation, being a little more clear about what I want. You know, I think instead of saying like, we need bicarb, I want 3 amps of bicarb. I think that's helped, maybe.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Persistently clear communication is one of the things that often will come about. And when people are going over incidents that happened, or when Sean Josephs is talking about things that went wrong during grand rounds, a lot of times it comes down to a communication issue. Mm-hmm. So that makes a lot of sense. So with all of the things that happen in a given week for you, how do you recharge? How do you get back to feeling like yourself after a long week at the hospital and at home?
Despite the fact that tiny humans are a lot of work, I love going home and playing with my son. My daughter's just turned 8 months. She's fun. She's not super interactive.
Sure.
But, you know, seeing her smile and do her little velociraptor screeches when you're playing with her is always great. My son is a joy. I mean, he's got a great imagination. So we go outside, we play, you know, we run around, hide from monsters, whatever. And then once the kids are finally in bed, even though that's, you know, fun to play with, like, you need a break.
Yes.
So, you know, that's time for like me and my husband to kind of reconnect and recharge. We watch a lot of TV, a couple different types of series we got going on, or play video games together.
That's definitely a great way to connect. Can confirm. So what advice would you give for residents who feel like a black cloud is following them, or that they seem to find themselves in dumpster fires all the time?
Yeah, I don't think I am ripping off a song or a movie lyric, but my own personal mantra is you cannot change the weather, but you can prepare for the storm, especially as it comes to, you know, black clouds. And that's really it. I feel like, you know, they've actually done studies looking at so-called black clouds in the ED. Typically, and they found that there's actually not a difference in like call shifts or the amount of patients that like they have. It's just somehow they seem to get worse patients or things of that nature. So like if you feel like you have acquired said black cloud energy, prepare for it. Read about emergencies, the things that are rare, the things that you don't expect to happen, and go into each case thinking, what's the worst case scenario?
So if you could go back and give yourself right around graduation, right before fellowship, a piece of advice for becoming a new attending, being a new graduate, what advice would you give yourself?
Imposter syndrome is real and it's not your fault. I legit probably had an existential crisis thinking, am I really just this bad at my job that all these bad things keep happening? And it was nothing in my control, but it kind of feels like that. And don't be afraid to reach out for help, which I've never have been. I'm always quick to call for help if I feel like I'm in over my head. I have no shame in that. But I think reinforcing that, because I do see that as a problem with people as they graduate. They feel like I'm the new attending. I have to prove myself. I shouldn't call for help. Don't be afraid to call for help.
That is something that I've shared with a lot of our new attendings as well. And fortunately, I think that that's a really strong part of the culture here, mm-hmm. is calling each other, running things by each other. I have certainly run plenty of things by you. Lastly, what kind of style points, just backing up a little bit and not just talking about disasters, but what kind of style points or piece of advice would you have for residents, medical students, and anesthesiologists in general that have helped you with your life, with your career, and everything else?
Organization. I still do like my resident write-up of my patients beforehand. It's not as detailed as it used to be, but I still have all my like basic concerns, and that's why I can, you know, if I'm running three rooms, I can take a quick peek. Oh, here's my risk factors. Here's what I'm worried about. You got to take care of yourself before you can take care of other people. It seems super cliche, but if you're totally burned out, like, that's not going to help your patients.
So put the oxygen mask on yourself first when starts to crash.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I throw out so many tidbits intra-op of just like little things that I'm like, oh, this will make your life easier. Like, your stylet will actually fit in the back of the plumb pump, and you can use that to make a hanger for your drugs when you don't have the metal piece.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot of little stuff like that that I really like showing people as well. Well, Kristen, thank you so much for joining us. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Style Points. If you enjoyed the show, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating or a quick review. It really helps other people find us. If you didn't enjoy the show, please put your feedback in the anesthetic record so that no one will ever read it. You can reach us anytime at stylepointspodcast@gmail.com. Style Points is recorded in front of a live studio audience who have all been sitting very quietly in the background this entire time. Thank you all for graciously remaining silent. And remember, if you pledge today, you'll receive a Style Points tote bag, available exclusively to our platinum level supporters, which feels like it should definitely be a tier that exists. Take a deep breath. Open your eyes. We're all done.